Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. This is from KansasCityDefender.com. Kansas City's cash bail system is destroying black wealth. December 6, 2021 by Amia Cook, Dylan Piles, and Black Rainbow. In 2020, Jackson County Justice System announced plans to build a new mass caging facility. The reason the existing facility has deteriorated into living hell is because Kansas City Police Department continues to wage its decade-long war against black, brown, and low-income people. To make matters worse, the majority of these detained at the Jackson County Detention Center have committed no crime. They are being held pre-trial, which means they are being held in jail because they are unable to pay the bail required for their release. The current detention facility is infamous for its nightmarish conditions, which violate human rights laws. It's not unusual to see help signs pressed against the outside-facing windows of the building. Despite the horrific upkeep of the building, the violent abuse of its people who are imprisoned, the county predicted that its total jail population will increase 32% by 2050. Building a new facility is based on the assumption that the jail populations will surge over the next 30 years, as will the demand for their services. This misleading propaganda is produced by the JCDC Partners, a private group of developers who profit from jails constructions, and others, mostly rich white people, who benefit from the imprisonment of black people. To be clear, jail populations have nothing to do with public safety. If safety was a priority, the same money being used to cage people would instead be for mental health services, housing, transition services to assist people in leaving jails, not having nice cages to live in. What we are proposing and what black people have demanded for decades is for our jail populations to decrease, for our focus to be on releasing people and transitioning people out of jails. This would be a far more impactful way to invest our money, especially given to the vast majority of people that are in jail that are there because they cannot afford to pay bail. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right, Mike.
I pray, dear Lord, for Jesus' sake, give us this day a T-bone steak. Hallowed be thy holy name, but don't forget to send the same. Oh, hear my humble cry, O Lord, and send us down some decent board, brown gravy and some German fried, with sliced tomatoes on the side. Observe me on my bended legs, I'm asking you for ham and eggs, and if thou havest custard pies, I'd like, dear Lord, the largest size. Oh, hear my cry, almighty host, I quite forgot the quail on toast. And let your kindly heart be stirred, and stuff some oysters in that bird. Dear Lord, we know your holy wish, on Friday we must have a fish. Our flesh is weak and spirit stale, you better make that fish a whale. Oh, hear me, Lord, remove these dogs, these sausages of powdered logs, your bull beef hash and bearded sprouts, take them to hell or thereabouts. With alum bread and pressed beef butts, dear Lord, you damn near root my guts. Your whitewash milk and oleorine, I wish to Christ I'd never seen. Oh, hear me, Lord, I'm praying still, but if you won't, our union will. Put pork chops on the bill of fare and starve no workers anywhere. Amen.
I'm sorry, Carl. I thought we should, you said play some music after that. So I misread you, what you said. So I put on a,
well,
for the holiday,
I mean,
I put on Utah Phillips praying for food.
Well, no, I was a choir boy at one point. It was a Lutheran church, but yeah, I remember my days with the boys choir. And sounded a lot like Utah Phillips, come think of it. And so, yeah, we try to get some Wallies together.
I thought after that news clipping about cash bail, I thought, well, you know, what about people who don't even have cooking stoves, you know? So I thought, what am I going to play? I'll play that one about a long-haired preacher. Prayer for the Lord's Will, I think is the name of that, actually.
Well, in the Little Red Songbook, IWW Little Red Songbook, it's Wobbly Doxology.
Oh, well, I'm sure it is. Yeah, that makes more sense. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's a good title. So... What's doxology? All right. So what's up? I mean, we got lots of clips with us. Carl has been very busy this week. you gave lots of clips to play.
This is really a good catch-up time for grabbing these articles. It's the end of the year, and everybody's trying to get their stories out so then they can say, back in 2021, we posted this article. You know, because like this jail, I don't know if they've broken ground quite yet. I mean, they've probably been excavating at the new jail. So that's a big thing. It just come in the news last night that Emmanuel Cleaver has $50 million to rent in disbursement for rents. So, well, yeah, I mean, Cleaver saves the real estate market.
I did not know that. Scandal around Cleaver, Reverend Cleaver, was about the it's an old one, something about a car wash. I mean, that's how far back I go. I didn't read that in the paper. And then there's this, in the Kansas City Star last week, it was these big front page articles that I'd started to read about a land grab of empty buildings on the east side. I mean, I don't understand. We're going to have to dig into that. I'm going to have to go find that copy and ask you about some of it, because I didn't realize there was such a lucrative business in buying up abandoned buildings in east side Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, it's a good place to sock your money. The taxes are cheap, and then you got a write-off for doing repairs. What I'm seeing is like a lot of unemployed nephews and folks like that basically get to crash in the building as they do repairs. And
there's nothing wrong with that, but there is something wrong with, I guess there's some people that are big developers or something. I don't know what they call them.
No, they're coming. I mean,
a whole bunch of
There's also scams. There's people going around putting We Buy Homes and putting their phone numbers on the east side and doing refinance packages and stealing people's property. And they're also...
wait a minute. You're surely not in favor of I don't know. I mean, it looks to me like there's people buying up multiple homes and turning into landlords. It's not just one family or homeless, unemployed people getting a home to fix up and stay in it. You know what I mean? And they can call it their home. You know what I mean? No.
It sounds like there's
people that are buying up lots of properties. Go ahead and tell me
right.
What's going on.
Well, there's a real estate company in New York City that takes foreign investment and buys these properties on the east side. One of them was Casey Tenet's biggest opponent, where they were going around video and just showing rats running around in the basements and mold on the walls and furnaces that don't work, and there was just like no end. They had, a media team out interviewing people. And Kansas City has the largest eviction. Of any city in the United States. So destabilizing the working class is an industry. And you can say it's the factory of the billionaires, because real estate is indeed the factory of the billionaires. So the point of contention is why does working class people have to play Jeff Bezos' game every day? How come they get paid first? You know,
what's wrong with people having their own homes? You know, that's the thing that screws me up. And you got to play with all these mortgage companies and all the, and then these people, these bigger people who buy up whole bunches of homes and then turn them into where you're paying rent. And everybody should know, anybody that's worked, that rent is slavery. I mean, that's a good old thing. Or, rent is theft. Call it whatever you want. But, rent, paying rent's not fun. You don't get anything out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're basically an in-country refugee.
Yeah,
I mean, if people would look at it like, hey, I'm going to be on the frickin' move the rest of my life, you know, until I'm physically too disabled to move anymore, and then wherever I can keep the rain off of me is where I'm going to set up my home until I die.
Yeah, they make a goddamn movie with that, I can't remember, she's a great actress, Nomadland. They make a movie, Nomadland, and about how idyllic it is to live homeless in some RV working for Amazon, of all places. Man, can you believe that fucking Hollywood? Jesus Christ. Excuse me.
Well, no. It's they did the same thing. You know, we talked about Hooverville, you know, and they mentioned that you started seeing movies, and some of them were named after the Wobbly songs, like Big Rock Candy Mountain, and so it was just the hobo, you know, living off the land, free and easy. And nothing's free and nothing's easy, especially out here on the prairie. You know, I mean,
they sure caught their ancestors into coming. That's the big Kansas pond. I mean, it came out here in 1850s. Our ancestors came out free land, free men, and free soil. Free land, free men, and free soil. Free state, Kansas. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's see. I think we got a caller. I'm just gonna put this caller on. He's got his hand up. Hold on. All right, caller. Hello, you're on the air
with Carl. Hey, what's good? This is Lamar. What's cracking?
Hey, Lamar. Yeah,
what's up?
Last Saturday show, we were just talking about emergency relief for the tornadoes that hit the factories in Maysville, Kentucky, and Edwardsville, Illinois. They were locked in. They were locked in by the managers. And now phone conversations are starting to show up with between drivers and dispatch. And there was an 80-minute warning of the tornado hitting Edwardsville. And they needed the command and control center from the corporate office to evacuate the damn factory for 5 hours, at which time it was destroyed. I mean, half of it was looked like a mower run right through it. At least 6 days. And the candle factory is over 20.
Over 20 what?
Over 20 people killed at Candle.
Wow.
Dead people,
yeah.
But hey, they have really finished.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the workers need to, like, you know, no longer recognize legitimacy to any bosses or anything like that, and just straight utilize the instruments for the working class who works it. You know, the class that works it. You know, this a brother just died in a factory through a temp agency, who just got released from a prison into a psych unit. You know, they had him on at work, and, you know, they overworked him. He just fell out dead, you know, and the, and they have links with the, you know, with the correctional system, the factory, with the temp agencies, you know, it's all, you know, capitalistically interconnected, you know, and we have to cut that Gordian knot, you know, with the sword of sheer revolution, you know, with people reclaiming our lives collectively. You know, this type of stuff is it's unnecessary, and it's a tragic non-necessity, you know, that we could alleviate ourselves from through a revolutionary organization.
Indeed. 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 And, you know, we're seeing people walk off. Since September, we've seen like 5 million people quit their jobs because it was too dangerous to be exposed to COVID. So it's more dangerous. Somebody posted last night on Twitter, it's more dangerous to work in a restaurant as a waiter and a cook than it is to go to a demonstration and watch people, the anti-vaxxers, complain about having to take inoculations to help and wear masks to stop the spread of COVID-19. And now we're getting ready to hit a wave that is going to be more deadlier than anything. I mean, this is like the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald or something. I mean, this is we're at sea. We're at sea, and we got the hatches locked down, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
and, hey,
we lost their lives, you know. This is literally a class war. You know, war doesn't necessarily have to involve, you know, combat boots and ARs, you know, and any other, you know, helmets and stuff. It's, you know, the system, the capitalistic system has devised sophisticated and charismatic ways of leeching on us, you know, sucking the lives right out of our flesh, you know. So it's, these are things that's worthy of consideration, you know, just like that's on a nonlinear wavelength of warfare, you know, so must we, you know, think of dynamics that are asymmetrical in nature, you know.
Yes, a diversity in tactics.
Yes.
Yeah. Where are people hurting? Where is the most need right now that is close to you? And you know, so we try to help with free store. We try to find good small appliances and things that people can use in the winter on the interim. And we're trying to, you know, we try to keep an eye on food.bombs here, and they cook every Sunday, and that's been our longest running food.bombs, and I think it's been going for like 8 years now, and it's like the fourth rendition of food.bombs. So seeing little things like that take hold. You
yeah,
know,
that's righteous. That's those little things add up, you know, and dots are being connected. You know, I remember when I went down to Atlanta, you know, and I was down there for like 4 or 5 months, and you know, it was phenomenal and fascinating. The irony of me going down there, I had a Chicago Food Not Bomb T-shirt on. You know, with the hand gripping the carrot and everything, you know, like, you know, that's grassroots resistance, you know, in the, you know, most essential level right there, you know, physically wise. And while I was washing dishes at the collective after we, you know, got done serving the people in the park, you know, washing the dishes, I had my T-shirt on, you know. It was a Atlanta Food Not Bombs thing going, you know, and the brother next to me was like, man, it's all coming together. I was like, you already know. So it's Keith McHenry, you know, who co-founder of Food Not Bombs, so I had the pleasure of meeting, you know, in the downtown train, you know, in the shot, you know, he, we never even think he was a revolutionary that started Food Not Bombs, you know, co-founded Food Not Bombs. He just looks like a regular Joe. You know, like mm-hmm. someone walked down his, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, he's yeah. So it's having this kind of energy and this you know, this vitriolic enthusiasm toward wanting to feed the people and feed our communities and help our communities, you know, these are very righteous things, you know, and the system uses double speak to make it appear as if we're the ones that got it all fucked up. You know what I'm saying? That we deserve to be, whatever, you know, that we're violating, you know, whatever. And, you know, and, you know, you go to one store, you know, you pay for something, a bag of chips, you know, you go to another store and it's a totally different price. You know, you go to the Dollar Tree or something and, you know, get some fishies or something, some Swedish fish, you know, and, or a jar of olives, you know, and, go to a store that, you know, go around to see how much it costs at 7-Eleven, you know, or, you know, a bag of Swedish fish, you know, or, you know, some candy, you know. So these are, you know, these are things having this grassroots resistance of food, not bombs, in different places throughout the country, throughout the world, you know, being on lines like this, callers listening in, you know, ears, you know, glued to their headphones, you know, and listening in on these things, because these are radical developments. You know, I don't want to take too much time on it, but so I just want to point that out. You know, that's, yeah.
Well, go ahead, Mike. Do you have something to say?
Okay. I heard you talking about the that song, "Big Rock Candy Mountain," and I've got it. We could play. I got a special rendition of it done by a guy named Frank Prophet. That must have been like 12 years ago. He made it for me, and it might be that wobbly tune you were talking about. But anyhow, sorry to interrupt you, Lamar. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Let's do a song. We'll let Lamar take a break because we got a 2-hour show now.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Yeah,
I'm trying to listen
right.
To the song. Yeah.
Oh.
All right, play it.
Good evening, class. Tonight's subject comes from a time in American history that scarcely resembles our own. You see, among other things, the weather was acting real funny. It hurt the crops. The small farmer was out on his own, not doing too well. The government was so deep in the pockets of Wall Street investment bankers that there was a housing crisis and a mass migration. Yes, a remote time indeed. Not all things are all bad or all good. And at the risk of spinning this into a didactic yarn, let us examine an anthropological subset that occurred as a result of these hard times. So now when you're farming on your share and you lose everything you got, and all you have is your two shoes, if you're lucky pants and a shirt, if the banker didn't ask you to take it off your back as you were walking out the door, well then you had to improvise, find new means of public transportation, and that's just what the hobo did. Short footnote here. To find out about the hobo's rail riding lives, it's good to consult Professor Woody Guthrie. Song Hobo's Lullaby. If you need further instruction on just what a hobo is, their sorts and condition, consult your IWW glossary. I'll give you time. Right next to Das Kapital. Top shelf. All right. Now, these hobos weren't just rail-riding, thieving ne'er-do-wells. Not all of them, at least. And within this culture, they built a system of language, code of ethics and honor, even a hieroglyphic system of writing. Why, to this day, if you live in an older house somewhere in Middle America, somewhere between Oklahoma and California, you can probably go out and look out on the fence post, find out how the previous owner treated people, whether he was a good Christian, an honest man, a plain dealer. Street investor, hedge fund manager, lion sack of shit, as it were. And last but not least, in this little intercourse, it's been good for me. The hobo developed his own mythological structure and system. And that is the subject of tonight's song. It comes out of the Hobo Hymnal, page 39.
Praise the Lord.
Given the way things are going, I think we could all use a little old-time religion nowadays. Some might stipulate that the place I'm going to sing about right now actually exists. About 6 miles due west of Cimarron, New Mexico. I don't know all about that. They wouldn't let me in because the Boy Scouts of America own it. But I'll keep looking. And one evening as the sun went down, the jungle fire was burning. Down the track came a hobo hiking. He said, boys, I ain't turning. I'm headed for the land, far away beyond the crystal fountains. So come with me and we'll go see Big Rock Candy Mountain. Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars are all empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees and the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the cops have wooden legs and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth and a hen lays soft-boiled eggs. Farmer's trees are full of fruit and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall and the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks and little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. Ain't no shorthand shovels, no axes, saws or picks. Well, I'm going the way where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work. I'll see y'all next coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Thank you.
That was Frank Prophet. And he made that for me, like I said, maybe 15 years ago or so. It seems like it. And I found it, and I thought I'd put it here on Carl G's, The Abolitionist Hour. And we got Lamar on the show tonight. A reminder, Carl, you wanted me to play this something, number 18, something about Graber, this guy Graber. We still got that up and coming.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead and play that. That's interesting.
All right.
We were talking, because we talked about David Graber and, you know, how we really have entered a new paradigm, how we think about ancient civilizations, how they actually became, went from hunter-gatherers to agricultural workers and then into cities. And Graber found that there were towns in the Ukraine that were like 100,000 people, but there was no city government. They were self-managed.
Yeah, that's strange. And
Code of Hammurabi, an eye for an eye.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's play it. Then we'll talk about
play it. Okay.
I come from the United States, where everybody is taught that democracy, you know, comes from the founding fathers who created the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, Constitution. And, you know, the amazing thing is if you actually look at the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, it doesn't say anything about America being a democracy. No one ever talks about this. And if you look at it, you know, and you figure out why, you read the original documents, you realize that actually those guys hated democracy. They said so all the time. You know, I actually saw the opening speech of the Constitutional Convention where people gathered together to create the American Constitution. And the first speech is by Governor of Virginia. He says, we've got a real problem in this country. There's a real danger of democracy breaking out. There's democratic elements in a lot of the local constitutions. We've got to do something about this. What are we going to do to prevent democracy? We need to create a federal system, you know, so forth and so on. So the entire constitutional project is an attempt explicitly to suppress democracy. Now, what did they mean by democracy? Well, they meant this. They meant people sitting around in squares, publicly discussing what to do and brainstorming ideas and resolving their own problems in an equal fashion. And why were they against it? They said very blatantly. I mean, John Adams, who's I think the third president, said, well, one man, one vote, that's insane. You can't have democracy. We have, you know, we have like 10 million people with no property and 1 million people with property. What do you think is going to happen if you get these guys the vote? You know, they're going to appropriate us right away. So they made very clear that there's no way you can have real democracy if you have vast inequalities of wealth without people actually taking, you know, undoing the great inequalities of wealth. Now, what they have done over the last 200 years is figure out a way, A, to take these institutions which were basically created to stop democracy and convince everybody they are democracy, and B, to, like, get people more and more involved in the system, since gradually they did expand it to one man, one vote, and still somehow not have them do the thing everybody was afraid that they were going to do in the beginning, which is appropriate the wealth. It's been one of the, you know, I mean, millions and millions of very ingenious people have been working on how to do this for years. It's one of the greatest pieces of propaganda ever done. But it's ultimately backed up by force. And the moment you really seriously challenge it, well, we all see what happens.
Thank you. And so I just want us all to be aware that we need to acknowledge that the wealth and the deep intelligence and the deep understanding of what true democracy is comes from the native people of what I only call the USA, because you can't call it America, because America is a huge continent.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I would add to that, which, people don't acknowledge, is most of the actual democratic elements that did end up in the American constitutional system originally come from Native Americans. So, I mean, the federal system is borrowed from Native Americans directly. I mean, the story of what actually happened historically has really not been told. Because we have this idea, we have these people who've just always been sort of these nature people, that don't have politics, their own. But actually, you know, when European settlers showed up in North America, what they really encountered was the result of hundreds of years of democratic movements within Native American society. There are these vast kingdoms, you know, in the Mississippian civilization were called caste systems, hierarchical, human sacrifice. Those things were overthrown, and they were overthrown by popular movements, and we're only now beginning to understand that happened within indigenous societies, which then created a remarkably individualistic and egalitarian democratic system. I mean, a lot of the Enlightenment was actually borrowed from Native Americans directly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Technology. Now, while it is true that historically capitalism has coincided with incredible amounts of technological creativity, most of that technological creativity has actually been funded by governments and not come out of private sector at all. And that's actually increasingly true. Or from the third sector, which isn't organized capital. Well, actually, a lot of primary research is now done neither by government nor by capitalists, but, by NGOs and other cooperatives. But the corporatization and capitalization of research has actually led to a massive decline of technological innovation and growth. It seems to be, as a system, we're seeing capitalism has really come to about its limits in terms of its very ability to provide the thing which had been its major advantage, which was rapid and spectacular technological innovation leading to greater possibilities and prosperity, which allows wealth to be redistributed to a degree where the, you know, that normal tendency for wealth to accumulate, which so many people, most recently Piketty, have observed, could be to some degree undercut. So it seems to me we've got at a period where capitalism has really gone, you know, it had a good historical run, but on every major measure we can find, it's running out of steam. It's no longer able to provide greater equality. It's creating greater inequality. It's no longer able to create technological innovation on anything like the scale it had before. If anything, it seems to be a brace against such innovation. It no longer seems to be able to provide relative levels of peace and security for people. And at exactly the moment where it seems to be failing on all fronts, it seems surprising to me that there is a sudden movement within people who 30 years ago would have been against it to say, well, maybe we can save it from itself. Some of them were actually kind of ironically quite good, like the state basically sort of pulled up stakes and
it because they figured they weren't getting any taxes out of the countryside anyway, and were sort of managing their own affairs completely autonomously, and that was cool. But they also did things like withdraw support for mosquito eradication programs. The idea being, you know, IMF would set the terms for debt rescheduling and demand various budget cuts. In this case, there was a program that had been put in 50 years before to wipe out malaria in the highlands, which had been very successful. People had all lost their immunity, but they couldn't afford to keep it up anymore when they had to cut the budget. And as a result, I believe 15,000 people died, 10 or 15, depending on the accounts. The epidemic came back. Everyone had lost their immunity. At least 5,000 of those were children. And this had happened right before I came to Madagascar. A lot of people were actually quite devastated by the experience. And I was telling the story, and she was very sympathetic, and she said, well, yes, but what were you, you know, as an activist, what were you proposing to do about this? And I said, well, we were involved in the Drop the Debt campaign, this thing called Jubilee 2000. I said the debt of the global south should be forgiven. And her reaction was somewhat shocked and mortified. She said, well, they borrowed the money, you know, I mean, surely people have to pay their debts. Just so commonsensical. And, you know, as an activist, you know, your first reaction when you see this is say, oh, bad conversation, all right. Yeah, I thought this was a friend. Okay, wait, which one do I do? You know, there's like 12 different responses you can do. Do I say, well, they didn't really borrow the money. Some dictator who put it in the Swiss bank account. You say, well, actually, they paid this money about 20 times over at this point just through the miracle of compounded interest. You know, they'll never get out. There's a million different responses. Actually, the response I think I came up with thought would be most effective in that context was the economical one, which is, you know, if profits are your reward for taking a risk, well, you're supposed to be taking a risk. So, I mean, the whole point of a financial system is to guide money towards wise investments, and if you have a system like the IMF imposed on most of the world where you're going to get paid back no matter what you do, there's absolutely no incentive to make intelligent loans. But what really struck me was that sort of commonsensical, you have to pay your debts. I thought, well, this is a very nice person. She just heard a story which involved 7,000 dead babies. What other circumstance would she try to justify killing 7,000 babies? Probably not.
Yeah, probably not. Whoa. I mean, there's a lot of billionaires that have their blood on their hands. In fact, I think it was Marx that said that the history of capitalism is covered with blood from head to toe. So 400 years of slavery, there's nobody more than the brown and black people of this country that know about disenfranchisement. And there's big arguments going on. Trying to ban books and stuff that introduce intersectionality to young people so that...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lamar.
No, I was disagreeing with you and like with full enthusiasm, you know. It's messed up. I just found out. I just Googled, you know, Habashi Lamar, my name, and scrolled down and found out that three of my writings are banned in all Florida prisons. You know, the depriving the praise is, you know, what was it, when all else feels lost, and we who stand the most, like we who stand the most to gain from, you know, getting things together, from, you know, to getting it together. You know, they banned these three, and there's, you know, other bands, you know, there's a plethora of other banned books as well, that's banned books and banned writings, you know, And in my writings, I speak of these very, you know, these very things about the need for, you know, for to be an evolution of consciousness, you know, and when you evolve consciously, you evolve conscientiously somehow in the midst of it all, you know, and the more people read and, you know, internalize things, you know, the more that they learn, the more that they become critical, the more they live a self-enjabbing existence, you know, and they don't want that on the inside. You know, they want people to stay stuck on what they want people to stay stuck on, you know? And, you know, so it's this, you know, one of the things that Paulo Freire said and Pedagogy, you know, Pedagogy of the Oppressed was, in order for the oppressed to be able to wage the struggle for their liberation, they must perceive the reality of oppression not as a closed world from which there is no exit, but as a limiting situation which they can transform. Prisoners of all sorts and various alleyways and trailer parks and projects and, you know, everywhere that, you know, Brian and I was building on before when we was, when all of us were formulating IWOP, you know, these are things that it's a primordial soup, you know, of the resistance, you know, it's what's fermenting, you know, and they know what's fermenting. They know, you know, the system, you know, it knows, you know, people on the inside, once exposed to liberating ideas, can become motivated with the intoxifying genius of a Malcolm or, you know, of a George Jackson or, you know, or Lorenzo, you know, where Lorenzo was already conscious, you know, but, you know, since he was like 12, he was in like SNCC or something, you know. So,
But, Quasi, you know, Quasi Belagoon. Let's talk about Quasi Belagoon.
Yes. Yeah, Quasi, he was a dynamic figure, a dynamic human being. And his motivation was fueled with a love for the people, you know, just like George's, just like Malcolm, just like, you know, Harriet Tubman, you know, just like Lucy P, you know. So yeah, Kawasi, he was remarkable, remarkable poet. You know, he served time in the war, you know, in the military industrial complex as well as the prison industrial complex, you know. So, you know, you know, he been through his share of warfare in its many dimensions. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't know is he came out with an exercise manual, a revolutionary workout manual, you know, one that I use, you know, and I'm telling you, it's one heck of a workout. You know, he teaches you how to expand your lungs by doing bends and thrusts, you know, by going down, you know, with your knees and straightening your knees again and putting your arms up and doing the same thing again, you know, counting reps, you know. So he recognized the psychosomatic nature of solidarity that one can have with oneself. And when this kind of realization is entertained in the minds and dynamic enthusiasm of the hood and of people behind lock and key, you know, they exercise something totally able to take off and uplift, and the system knows that.
Well, that's right, because mutiny and strikes, these are the biggest threats to capital.
Yep. And the largest threat to capital is a mutiny of the mind, because once the mind resists, it could direct the limbs to do what it will with the instruments that are in front of them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how people have a little bit of experience just in like marching, or with like, you know, and understanding how groups move you know, even watching, you know, video of people in New York City crossing a crosswalk, how they all come together and organize to cross at the crosswalk, and then they expand back out once they get through that. And to me, mm-hmm. anarchism is how they organize their tasks, you know, as a component to the movement. You know, it's a tendency more than an ideology. So,
yes.
You know, it's, yeah. Well,
yeah. It's a living praxis. You know, it's a healthy way of living, because you free yourself from being captives in the naivete of believing that someone else can think for you and it'll be in your best interest. And, you know, walking with arms extended and closed eyes and Frankensteinian sync with the rest of the people who are in the illusion that it is what it is, instead of it's what you can make it to be, you know, and to, you know, so to wake from that zombified, apathetic, blinklessly staring into a future that you have no narration and the self-determination of, you know, you become lost in the void, you know, and a lot of people don't realize it until their life is just swiped away. You know, a lot of people, that's it on the inside, you know, they didn't think about, wow, you know, kill, you know, somebody that just, you know, looked like me in the hood and the same economic conditions, and why was the reason why he's in the same economic conditions, and you know what I'm saying, like, all right, well, who's responsible for the both of us being in this situation, you know? And when they realize that not only is it, it's not necessarily people, it's the idea, like Bertman talked about, Alexander Bertman and ABC of Anarchism, the idea is the thing, you know? Once the people, get the idea, you know, we have a cornucopia of cornucopias, you know, at our disposal. And the world is our oyster. It becomes our oyster, you know, because we become one with the oyster.
Well, it's the supply and demand of capitalism. I mean, it's a boom or bust. It's a boom or bust system, which makes it perfect for real estate and mass incarceration, because overnight people find themselves on the street all over the country.
Yeah, that hurts. That's what I'm saying. Lucy Parsons talks about, if anybody gets a chance listening to this podcast, when you go to sleep tonight, listen to, go to YouTube and type in Lucy Parsons' speech to the tramps. And when you listen to that, you know, it's going to be somebody else saying, you know, speaking her words, you know, I forget what's the name of that word, where somebody else transliterating with, like, oral transliteration or something. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, reading some of her speeches from the 1930s.
Message to the tramps, every working class person, everybody who's been laid off, everybody who's been like mean mugged by the boss, you know, for doing something they felt is right, you know, instead of doing something that the boss felt was best for the product at the stake of numbers, you know, and, you know, production, you know, listen to it, and it's short. I forget how many minutes it is, but it's not even, I don't even think it's like 7 minutes or something, you know, and it's somewhere, but she, that's an important, that right there, it's in zine form available. It's only like a page, but it's in zine form available through South Chicago Anarchist Black Cross, P.O. Box 721, Homewood, Illinois, 60430. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, everybody, every worker should have that in their backpack when they go to work. You know what I'm saying? And you just read it. And, you know, when you walk, you or drive or a bike or however you get back, waiting in the bus stop, wherever, you know, that's a, we're listening to it in the headphones, you know. These are things that working class folks who vote, whose light bulb is on, that before us, you know, we're having this, these very, like, goosebumps coming at the flesh of our thought life and the way that we vibrate, you know, on this level, because a lot, so many people are pissed off. So many people are, don't get paid enough. So many people are getting booted, not getting enough hours, you know, trying to put in for partial unemployment, you know, is like, you know, dealing with the computers on the phone. If you only got a phone, it's not, you know, so it's, you know, there's so many, you know, people dying at work, you know, and, you know, for what? It's like, you know, it's all the stuff that we produce every single shift. Just imagine, you know, if that was, if we received the fruits of our labor, the full fruits of our labor, you know, we wouldn't even have, we would have too much to fit in our place by the end of the week. We would have to, we would, you know, just give it away because it'd be so much just from our shift, just from our job, you know? You know, it's something, so, you know, years later, we shouldn't have to be trying to think, well, hey, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, you know, 60 years later, whatever, you know, I'll get disability. You know, I'll be able to, you know, be comfortable and everything. You know, when the capitalists who ain't doing nothing, you know, while we doing all the work, you know, ain't doing nothing and don't have to worry about that. That doesn't make sense. And the people know that. And the people like Lucy Parsons knew it back then, you know, and Marx knew it, you know. I'm not exactly a Marxist, you know, but he had a lot of brilliant ideas, you know, and Bakunin, you know, you know, Bakunin, he was just remarkable, you know. He was an individual who actually lived like a revolutionary life, participating in revolutions physically. You know, he was dynamic, you know. So, you know, and they knew it back in the 1800s, you know, and people knew it before then, you know. People, you know, babies know it. They start crying if somebody takes their candy, you know, and if they have one and the other baby has one, you know, the toddler or whatever, and instead of eating theirs fairly, and they take the other one and, you know, try to say, well, you have to pay me a bottle, you know, which will call us, even the babies know it. The babies, you know, it's natural, you know, being taken advantage of, nobody likes it. That's not right. That's not equal. How can it be equality if there's a country of equality, if there's upper, middle, and lower class? There's no equality. It's all a facade. The system is brainwashing people. How can it be an equality in this country if there's, or in this world where there's United Nations and stuff, but there's first, second, and third world countries that even this country, like, acknowledges as, you know, it's not equality, but they have the people brainwashing, you know, into being patriotic to a nation of equality, you know, you know, the double speak we were talking about, and just straight brainwashing, you know. So when people listen to podcasts, revolutionary podcasts like this, when people read from revolutionary literature like stuff from South Chicago, ABC, Union Distro, or from IWOC, you know, this grassroots form resistance, you know, people become enlightened, you know, and at the same time, people have to beware, people have to be careful, because when you become enlightened, you become like a candle, like the flame on a candle. And that candle, it attracts moss, you know, and so it's good to, you know, watch the walls, you know, in the shadows, you know, and things like that, you know, because you have the system, you know, whether it's prison guards, whether it's people trying to make you look, discredit you or make you look bad, trying to make you, whatever the situation may be, talk about, you know, the home you live in or whatever, which you may have done in the past or, you know, instead of what's going on right now, you know, because
yeah.
You know right now it's something serious.
Yeah, so it's we have to listen to the storytellers before we can become a storyteller ourselves. And
right. I was just going to say it's important to become the narrators of our own existence for us to be self-definers, you know, in addition with that light works hand in hand with that. Yep.
Yeah,
because
so
people trying to tell us who we are. People trying to tell you who you are. People trying to tell, like, whoever's listening, don't ever let anybody tell you who you are and then to the point where you believe it when you could ask yourself who you are and listen to the voice of your intuition that tells you who you are and say the positive affirmations about yourself. You know, I'm someone who listens to podcasts that will uplift humanity. You know, the more and more people that get involved, and even with my very self, by getting something from listening to this podcast, you know, so, but my fault, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was just completing the thought. Go ahead, Carl.
I like where you're going with this, because, you know, once we feel connected and energized, and we're talking inside an anarchist framework, where if you got
right.
four or five people, there's something you can do that day to make the situation better in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep, that's right. One person walking up, this is one way somebody could get involved, all right, could get active simply. You know, you could just, however way you want to go about it, this is like a good basic. Get a clipboard. On the clipboard, ask no more than three questions. This is one of the things I do, you understand, it's been effective for me, you know, in Englewood, when I'm saying Chicago. So, you know, getting a clipboard and asking no more than three questions because you don't want to burn somebody out, you know. And the questions could be as simple as, do you believe the police are racist in Kansas City? You know, do you believe?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe? If you had a vision of what you would like San Antonio to be right now, if you had one thing that you could give for San Antonio in the hood right here, you know, if this person is in San Antonio, of course. What would that one thing be that the system ain't given to the hood? You know, having that is, you know, that engages the people. It shows people that someone's interested in, which this capitalist system definitely don't do, except for at election time when they're blowing your phone up trying to tell you to get you to vote for them. You know what I'm saying? So having these things, and then with those answers, after walking a block, you know, walking whatever perimeter block you want to walk, you choose to walk on, which you could write in your notebook, or I used to use the whiteboard with a Sharpie, you know, literally drawing like a rectangle with the blocks, you know, and then go where I would go around and doing that with clipboard in hand, pen, you know, and leaflets, you know, leaflets of could be IWAT newsletters or zines, you know, some zines or whatever, but having a leaflet with a phone number, for example, like an IWAP phone number, or IWW phone number, for example, or BAF phone number, whatever, you know, and walking around and a contact so that they could reach out to if they want to get involved, basically. You know, going around with the clipboard and asking folks those questions. You know, do you believe the police are racist here on the East Coast? Do you believe, if you had a vision of what your community right here, right now in East LA would be like, would have, you know, that the system ain't given, what would it be? And then getting, and then, you know, having a, and then after that, having that compilation of knowledge that the people have, because that's where the knowledge essentially comes from the people, you know, that's where the real substance comes from, the needs, you know, the needs of the people, then, you know, then getting that, and then having the phone tree, you know, using the phone tree to, of different people who have, you know, different skills and abilities, you know, whether it's distributing leaflets, whether it's, you know, whatever the situation is, you know, with stamps or, you know, when may have a water key to help you, you know, to help the, put to help the entire thirsty community who's wiping the sweat of their 8-hour workday from their brow, you know, or it could be you know, whatever, but it could be a pair of bolt cutters, you know, that you could use, you know, for liberation, you know. And for the and to help people with, you know, so having having this together, you know, this is what's getting it together. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's, you know, you were talking about Englewood. We were talking about earlier. We were earlier in the week. We were talking about the heat wave that killed more people in Englewood in the South Yards. Killed more people than any disaster, Sandy, Katrina, Ida. So it was the most dangerous heat wave in Chicago in 1995. And Englewood, where you're from and where you do free school work and a lot of your reflection on your writing is from Englewood. Now you tell me you were actually in Pennsylvania at the time, but there was an effect that had an effect that far away, that what was going on in Chicago. Is that right?
Yeah, I just want to clarify. I'm from Pennsylvania, you know, but and I was at the time I was in prison in Pennsylvania, you know, but I've been living in, you know, Chicago over 10 years. So, and the majority of my work has been in Englewood, but I've worked in different areas too, in different neighborhoods, you know, like, you know, we'd be down, like, you know, in places that a lot of, like, activists don't really want to go down, and it's cool, I understand. Me, myself, I lost my fear of death. I have, so it makes my love for the people kind of magnetically drawn others, like people who see the sincerity to me in unacknowledged alleys and places like that, that's just totally neglected, and people who just alienated and, you know, socioeconomically marginalized with ghetto birds, you know, helicopters, police helicopters, you know, shining their lights down, you know, everywhere. So it's you know, these are communities where, like, you know, Englewood, Auburn Gresham, Grand Crossing, you know, like these neighborhoods, you know, are like, they're like war zones, and the reason, and the main war is like, and when I say war zone, I don't mean war zone in regards to gang, what's going on here, because more, for real, that's more like battles. To us, they're wars because we're sardine canned in these communities and stuff like that, and, you know, but like the major war, the capitalist, is the capitalist war, you know, the capitalism and the anti-capitalist conflicts that are arising between the haves and the conscious have-nots, you know, and more people are becoming radicalized. That's the war. That's, you know, because, you know, like in Englewood, all black neighborhood. Just like the only white folk there is the police or the ambulance people. You know, and we're talking about a community with like over like 70,000 people in it, you know? So which we'll call this and the people who own the stores, however, you know, are non-black, you know, and not saying that, you know, anything against anybody, like I'm not racist, I'm against racism and all that. But what I'm saying is that there's social contradictions that exist that it's imperative not to ignore, you know, and more people are becoming radicalized with these understandings, you know.
Yeah, and it happens quickly. You know, we had the economic downturn in 2008, and 3 years later we had an Occupy movement where 20,000 cities in the U.S. had some type of general assembly going on through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Power movement, the Black Panther Party, they did it right. No matter which way you look at it, they did it right. Like Lorenzo's talking about, you know, they started between 1955 and 1965. So, you know, there was a period of deep reflection and organizing, and of course SNCC was out, and I think Mike's back. But this, you know, we're talking about building movements, and how it starts with just one person getting out on the street and start asking questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you got an affinity group of like three or five, that's all the better, because especially when it's like mixed, you know, like, you know, mixed genders, mixed, you know, that's even more, because people identify more with a variety. There's a variety of people to identify with, you know, and in a time and epoch where people are questioning their identities and asking what each other's pronouns are, on such a vast scale, you know, it magnetizes more and more people, you know, to an enthusiasm of becoming in tune with themselves more, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the intersectionality is something that it's still new to some people. You're talking about what are our pronouns, and when you're in a meeting and you introduce yourself by your pronouns, it's how you identify physically and in emotionally, spiritually. It tells a lot about a person, during your introduction, that you don't have to wonder about, you know.
It also shows you that the other person is conscious of themselves, that they think about themselves, that they're reflective, that they, you know, it's those things like that, you know, that's making these, really great times, you know, like great times to be living in, you know, like amidst it all.
I didn't do a good job of explaining it. It's like, I didn't mean where they're coming from, but we've had situations where kids were in religious families, and you know, they you know, so they hid that, you know, they were gay for 2 or 3 years, you know, but then, you know, they were at the point, maybe they were 17 or 18, and maybe they got a little bit of money saved, and then they hit the road. And because there's no place else to go but to start moving, because you're in a, you know, they were in a little town in Indiana, and somebody calls us and says, yeah, we got a storm coming, and we, I know a guy down at the bus station and needs a place to stay. And yeah, it was just one of those times where it's just, you know, he shows up when we're hearing this. It's like unbelievable. It's like, you know, my parents threw me out because I'm gay and you know, I had to quit my job and because, you know, and so,
yeah.
You know, people in their, where they're at in their struggle, you know, shouldn't be a detriment to engaging in the movement and being accepted and comfortable. And that's how it spreads. So, you know, it starts with an idea, you know. Hey, do you think the police are racist?
Yep, you know, and that gets people to. It's so multidimensionally beneficial, you know, to these things. It gets us a closer. Like people get to see where we're coming from, you know, who may have been. Miseducated by the media to think that black people are like this or whatever, or, you know, only thinking about drugs or sticking somebody up. You know, it could get somebody to appreciate the fact that, a white guy with glasses who seems to, you know, just be cool, you know, would be asking, you know, taking a person in the mind, you know. So it's and the implications, you know, that evolve from it, you know. And yeah, and Kawasi, you know, like Kawasi, he was you know, he was openly gay, you know, he was bisexual, you know, and he was one of the first openly black anarchists who admitted that he, you know, he was gay, you know, and bisexual, you know, and that just, so it's like, people have been, when it comes to pronouns, people have been, thinking about these things for a while, but now it's start, like, people are asking those identity questions about themselves, you know, who am I, you know, who do I, you know, is this real, is this, you know, are things real, or are they illusion? You know, what's real from illusion? You know, the separation and the dichotomy, you know, like, you know, are things that we read in books, we read through study, and these are things that are deprived of minds that, you know, are behind the walls, you know, and these things are deprived in a lot of different ways to people on the outside because folks can't afford to buy a lot of books that folks want to read. You know, so having zine distros and, you know, like the one in not only South Chicago but, you know, also in Kansas City, you know, the Kansas City IWOC PO Box 414304, Kansas City, Missouri 64141. You know, having those having these kind of mediums, these, you know, resourceful gems, you know, able to internalize, yep, on the luxury of your favorite subway car, you know, line or wherever it may be, you know, and just internalizing them and filling one, you know, with the people who have chosen to resist, you know, and whose light bulbs are on as well, whose flame, you know, is, whose candle wick is lit, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. The numbers are, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I've been at work. You're a friendly little elf here at Christmas time, summer solstice or winter solstice time. And I have found the Lucy Parsons thing to play. The Lucy Parsons 1884, A Word to the Tramps, TRAMPS. Would you like to listen? It's only 6 minutes. Would you like to listen? Would you like to listen to it? Is that, does that sound like it, Lamar?
That sounds cool with me. How about you, Carl?
Yeah, yeah, Lucy Parsons, IWW, 1905.
A word to the 30,000 now tramping the streets of this great city, with hands in pockets, gazing listlessly about you with the evidences of wealth and pleasure, of which you own no part. Not sufficient even to purchase yourself a bit of food, with which to appease the pangs of hunger now gnawing at your vitals. It is with you and the hundreds of thousands of others similarly situated in this great land of plenty that I wish to have a word. Have you not worked hard all your life, since you were old enough for your labor to be of use in the production of wealth? Have you not toiled long, hard, and laboriously in producing wealth? And in all those years of drudgery, do you not know you have produced thousands upon thousands of dollars worth of wealth, which you did not then, do not now, and unless you act, never will own any part in? Do you not know that when you were harnessed to a machine, and that machine harnessed to steam, and thus you toiled your 10, 12, and 16 hours in the 24, that during this time and all these years you received only enough of your labor product to furnish yourself the bare, coarse necessities of life, and that when you wished to purchase anything for yourself and family, it always had to be of the cheapest quality? If you wanted to go anywhere, you had to wait until Sunday. So little did you receive for your unremitting toil that you dare not stop for a moment, as it were. And do you not know that with all your squeezing, pinching, and economizing, that you never were enabled to keep but a few days ahead of the wolves of want? And that at last, when the caprice of your employer saw fit to create an artificial famine by limiting production, that the fires in the furnace were extinguished, the iron horse to which you had been harnessed was stilled, the factory door locked up, you turned upon the highway, a tramp, with hunger in your stomach and rags upon your back. Yet your employer told you that it was overproduction which made him close up. Who cared for the bitter tears and heart pangs of your loving wife and helpless children when you bid them a loving God bless you and turned upon the tramper's road to seek employment elsewhere? I say, who cared for those heartaches and pains? You were only a tramp now, to be execrated and denounced as a worthless tramp and a vagrant by that very class who had been engaged all those years in robbing you and yours. Then can you not see that the good boss or the bad boss cuts no figure whatever, that you are the common prey of both, and that their mission is simply robbery? Can you not see that it is the industrial system and not the boss which must be changed? Now, when all these bright summer and autumn days are going by, and you have no employment, and consequently can save up nothing, and when the winter's blast sweeps down from the north and all the earth is wrapped in a shroud of ice, hearken not to the voice of the hypocrite who will tell you that it was ordained by God that the poor ye have always, or to the arrogant robber who will say to you that you drank up all your wages last summer when you had work, and that is the reason why you have nothing now, and the workhouse or the woodyard is too good for you, that you ought to be shot. And shoot you they will if you present your petition in too emphatic a manner. So hearken not to them, but list. Next winter, when the cold blasts are keeping through the rents in your seedy garments, when the frost is biting your feet through the holes in your worn-out shoes, and when all wretchedness seems to have centered in and upon you, when misery has marked you for her own, and life has become a burden and existence a mockery, when you have walked the streets by day and slept upon hard boards by night, and at last determined by your own hand to take your life, for you would rather go out into utter nothingness than to longer endure an existence which has become such a burden. So perchance you determine to dash yourself into the cold embrace of the lake rather than longer suffer thus. But halt before you commit this last tragic act in the drama of your simple existence. Stop. Is there nothing you can do to ensure those whom you are about to orphan against a like fate? The waves will only dash over you in mockery of your rash act, but stroll you down the avenues of the rich and look upon the magnificent plate windows into their voluptuous homes, and here you will discover the very identical robbers who have despoiled you and yours. then let your tragedy be enacted here. Awaken them from their wanton sports at your expense. Send forth your petition and let them read it by the red glare of destruction. Thus, when you cast one long, lingering look behind, you can be assured that you have spoken to these robbers in the only language which they have ever been able to understand. For they have never yet deigned to notice any petition from their slaves that they were not compelled to read by the red glare bursting from the cannon's mouths, or that was not handed to them upon the point of the sword. You need no organization when you make up your mind to present this kind of petition. In fact, an organization would be a detriment to you. But each of you hungry tramps who read these lines avail yourselves of those little methods of warfare which science has placed in the hands of the poor man, and you will become a power in this or any other land. Learn the use of explosives. Dedicated to the Tramps by Lucy E. Parsons.
The most dangerous woman in the world.
Yeah, the Chicago Police, Chicago Police Department.
I did not know.
The more dangerous than the Thousand Riders.
Yeah.
Oh, my fault. Go ahead.
No,
well,
so that was.
So that was
1988.
Oh, okay. Well, it says 1884. Lucy Parsons on YouTube, and I don't know. Maybe that must have been his Lucy Parsons, judging from the tone of the voice. I mean, I don't know why they didn't have a woman read it, but that's okay. I mean, was that the part? Was that the speech you were talking about? Speech to the Tramps, 1884.
Yeah, it's
Hello?
Universally understandable. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Now
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's holistically embraceable. You know what? It transcends gender. You know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a man reading it, a woman reading it, a gay person reading it, or whoever it could be anybody. You know, it's something that everyone could relate to. You know, everyone who's you know, who worked in factories or who been laid off and, you know, sent to walk like a tramp down the street, you know, to one of the streets, you know, looking for work and, one, you know, rubbing your hands together and blowing into the hollow of your palms. You know, very things that Lucy felt and understood. You know, these are things that people throughout the decades have had system. Yeah.
And Lucy Parsons was born a slave in East Texas. Is that right?
Yeah. She used to be a slave. You know, she was married to. Then she married Albert Parsons. Haymarket Martyr, you know, and you know, he changed his views from before, you know, and became an anarchist, you know, and so it's like that's the thing about the redemptive power of particularly anarchist revolution, like one where you don't govern anybody and you get out that, you know, phase of thinking and for anyone else to govern you is just, you know, it's not your head on your shoulders. And I'm like, what's the purpose of having your head on your shoulders? Like, hey, let me just use your head, you know? So it's having this kind of, you know, this kind of understanding back then, you know, highlights, you know, how real and how necessary the feeling of, resistance and applying it, you know.
Yeah, and so the term tramp is back then was what George Jackson would say, some men are, or some people are just broken. And so hobo comes from bohemian, and often they were skilled tradespeople that couldn't find work in the United States. And their disillusionment led them to anarchism. And so at the camps, when they began organizing homeless camps and train hopping cross country, it was an organized structure through the IWW in the United States. And it was believed that a hobo saw something over the top of the hill. They kept their vision, but when a person loses their vision, is what separated the hobo from the tramp. You know, where the tramp was wandering and the hobo, you know, was planning, for tomorrow. And I wonder if we're in a state in our society that there are a lot of broken people, and some of them can come out of it and some of them can't. And I feel we're dealing with a lot of heartache out on the streets. I talk to nurses that work in, they'll go to Greece and work in refugee camps.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, how is it that they've not died from a broken heart from seeing all this tragedy, all this struggle, you know, weeks on boats with little water and sanitation and helping these people recover from these traumatic events. And then there's just waves of traumatic events coming.
Yeah.
Those traumatic
events, are indicative of the class war between, those who have and the lumpen proletariat, which means broken workers. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's that feeling of being broke, inside a lot of times as a result of, you know, having your pocket being broke in your wallet or in your purse, you know, in a system that's driven off capitalistic requirements, you know, so, you know, having to, for example, having to go to the store to pay for water, you know, so, when someone's too broke to pay for, you know, a bottle of water when they're thirsty, you know, it could draw them to feel broken inside, you know, because, you know, the body is strengthened, you know, the bones are strengthened when it has nutrients and water is an element. Nutritious
mm-hmm.
that. So, you know, there's a direct correlation between the two. You know,
yeah.
And this still can be transcended. So, you know, like, but it comes with consciousness, you know, with having a consciousness of self, you know, where you reflect on yourself and who you are. How am I carrying myself today? Is this the type of person I want to be seen as? No? All right, well, let me change this about me and be this way. You know, is this the kind of person I could vibe with if I was with me?
Yeah.
Cool. You know what I'm saying? You know, and also mm-hmm. socially, you know. So, with a class consciousness of how class dynamics operate, you know, with the capitalist tier system, with, going through it all, just going through study, you know, like Jackson said in Blood in My Eye, I think it was in Blood in My Eye, you know, saying how he went through the gambit, reading everybody, you know, and studying, not just reading, but studying, you know, it's like a sincere inquiry into the nature of truth and reality, you know, within oneself and in the world that one is interconnected with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How, yeah, how we react and how we engage is very important. And, you know, we're hoping we're reaching out with our podcast on a pretty broad area. We're getting listeners on the West Coast. We're getting listeners on the East Coast and we hope that we're getting people out in the rural areas, because we're out here on the southern prairie of the Midwest, and we see, you know, transportation problems here in the city, and out here where the towns are small and scattered, it's hard to find like carpooling and Ubers are $25, you know, to get you 10 minutes down the road. And, you know, in some of these areas where there is better mass transit, like Brooklyn and New York, where it runs, the trains run around the clock. And it's, you know, and how they organize, I really feel reflects a lot about that, about how easy it is, you know.
Yeah, I know.
In comparison. Go ahead.
There's like really good stuff happening. I remember when it was like down at LES, down the Lower East Side, they have a squad down there that's been going on for, I think like 20, 30 years now, you know, a really cool squat that me and my ex used to, that we did too, and it was great. Right across the street, a whole block, just a whole community garden, you know. And with the trains, it kind of tripped me out because, you know, I got on a train, you know, in the Chicago trains, there's cameras in them, you know. So I was on way to the J train to Brooklyn and the J train, to Brooklyn. And, you know, there was no cameras on the train, you know, and it was like the free form, you know, it was kind of, it was just interesting, you know, like, but, you know, social environments aren't really that different, you know, when it comes to the capitalist system. We see, you know, whether we're in, New York, you know, in Kansas City or anywhere, you know, it's you know, transportation, you know, is something that we should, in my opinion, start tapping our pens on the paper and thinking about socializing as well, you know, the means of, you know, socializing the means of transportation is revolutionary. You know, it's something that was done in Spain, and, you know, revolutionary times, you know, that's where people do revolutionary things that, like, do away with the past, so things that just was like, you know, at the end, you're like, phew, I'm glad that's over with. You know, we get to live in freedom now, you know? Like, you know, so, yeah.
Well, yeah, we're in a situation, where we're trying to assess our gains, and we've seen the civil rights movement be dismantled. We've seen FDR being dismantled, and then we see the billionaires who have dozens of yachts, and you know, 96% of the population makes under $250,000 a year, which is what the capital gains tax is. And so we see, we are the 99% Occupy, but reality is probably we are the 96%. Because 4% are doing so damn well. You know, like the rocket that Bezos shot up last week, you know, it was enough carbon for a billion people to burn in a year.
Mm.
And this was just for a couple of rich people to go up into the stratosphere and come back down.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's time, you know, that's the difference between them and us. You know, they're psychologically out of our reach, and us, we're down to earth, you know, and we've been down to earth so long, you know, we know how to draw blueprints on things that can become out of this world, you know, from spacecraft to, you know, it's the workers who do it, you know, in the factory, and then, you know, having this understanding, you know, that it's us who produce everything, you know, even the calculators that the capitalists have their, their secretaries or whatever, you know, calculate how much they've made, how much profit they made. They're not even doing the single word. They're just, you know, doing what they want to do, you know, probably, who knows, hula hooping in Hawaii with a layers.
Seven or 10 yachts. You got 10 yachts. That's a full-time job to keep track of those.
Yeah, and I wouldn't mind if he has someone that he's paying to, they're paying peanuts to keep track of him. You know, that's it's how this world, like, when you, like, the Rockefellers, the Bilderbergs, like, you know, when you got, like, this kind of, like, when you got this kind of mass movement with that little tiny, you know, grain of sand that we could just, you know, wash away and overcome, you know, and, you know, it's, we refresh the land, we refresh, you know, we become able to blossom, you know, we overcome the obstacles, you know, and, you know, and of course we could do what we want. We become a whole bunch of grains of sand that can think as we choose, do as we choose, conscious grains of sand, you know, united on one front, you know, and, having this ability to be consciously empowered with the unity that class solidarity brings, you know, it gives us the ability to work effectively with others, to engage in others in the block, in the hood, you know what I'm saying? And at the 7-Eleven somewhere when, you know, you're trying to find a spot to take a leak at, you know what I'm saying? When you come out after you wash your hands, of course. Yeah. And,
Well, yeah, just seeing so many people distracted. Well, you know, you're talking about coming in out of 7-Elevens and things, you know, and I don't know if everybody's wearing masks where you're at, or how that's going, but
it depends where. Like this, in the stores, you know, you got a lot of store people behind the stores ain't wearing masks. You know, like in Chicago, there's like, you got some stores that wear masks, where folks is wearing masks, and you got others where they're close to one. You know, there's people inside, like regular, like patrons, like people, customers going into boxes or whatever, like probably like 50% wear masks and like 50% don't, obviously. You know?
Yeah, because I'm going in to pay for gas or something, you know, and I'm just like in and out of there, you know, and it's like, you know, you guys are trying to kill me. I'm staying away from you. And unfortunately, people who are working, I mean, you know, somebody on Twitter is saying, hey, I'm going to live off what I've saved from cooking and waiting tables, because it's too dangerous to work in a restaurant right now. And that might be even more dangerous than a 7-Eleven, where people are really just passing and going and the doors are open and air's flowing. So, but I see a lot of people at gas stations wearing masks.
Could you repeat that again? What was the last part you said?
Well, no, they come in, you know, a restaurant's more closed in. The customers are spending, you know, 30 or 40 minutes at a table. You know, they're trying to keep it warm and comfortable. And, you know, it's recirculated air. You know, we're handling plates, you know, and, you know, it's just so risky. And, you know, being a waiter and a cook depends so much on your health.
Yeah.
And
at this one restaurant I was at, you know, in Pennsylvania, they was just, you know, fancy restaurant people, like, rich folk, like, throwing away whole plates of, like, you know, steaks and stuff, like, as if they just smelled it and then was like, oh, not this fragrance today. It's something, you know, and, you know, just toss it, gave it, you know, to throw away, so people in the back eating the, you know, like, dishwashers, eating, you know, the plates from the stuff that folks, you know, throw away. These are, like, you know, $40, $50 plates. You know, you just throw it away, and, you know, and, you know what I'm saying? So it's, yeah, it's wild, you know, like in Chicago, you know, they padlock the dumpsters so that, like, the extras, you know, that they have at the stores, you know, throw them out so people can't get inside the dumpsters to, you know, to eat the bags of chips they throw out, you know, because of, you know, so it's like
expiration dates and. Yeah, and you're talking about like a fifty dollar plate of food. I mean, I'm not sure what a cook or a waiter's making these days, but
not much.
You know, I don't remember people eating a lot. Most of the restaurants I worked at, most of the people who worked there could not afford to eat there.
I couldn't, you know, and I was like busting my ass working the, you know, I was like trying to tell you. You know, it was like, you know, have my, you know, my bandana in my pocket, you know, washing the, busting the dishes, wiping my head, you know, from the sweat and everything. And, you know, I couldn't afford, you know, like my salary, I could afford probably like, you know, like one plate or like 3/4 of that plate, you know, that they throw away at one sitting, you know. So it's, and they didn't look like, you know, they was like they didn't look like they had calloused hands, you know. So it's I don't know.
No, I know what you mean. I've seen that, you know, folks take one bite and I don't like it, you know, and it's like so many times we're just trying to get enough calories for the day. You know, to you know, just put one foot, you know, in front of the other, and so it's much more rewarding being able to work with the food not bombs and do liberation work,
and the food tastes better too, and it's healthier.
Yeah. There's a lot of we find a lot of good cooks. I was telling somebody about the tofu scramble. I don't know if who that was, but that's kind of a highlight. You know, people like are proud of the tofu scramble, and so making a good breakfast in the morning, they'll bring teams in that's their specialty is you know, prepping the American fried potatoes and grilling the onions and you know, the turmeric with the tofu and, you know, just having it just right. And it's like, wow, just from front to back, that whole plate was just consistently good. And that's,
man, you got me over here on the line, on the radio, licking my eyebrows right now. Like, hey, like we used to have like, well, first of all, you know, revolutionary salutes and, humanitarian love for all the, you know, to all the food not bombs, to all the FMBs everywhere, you know, in Kansas City and Atlanta and everywhere where folks is feeding human beings that, you know, in a world where capitalists throw food in a dumpster and padlock and close so, you know, people whose stomachs are touching their backs in the alley can't get inside them, you know. You know, salutes to all the food not bombs, you know, and we need more food and that's dropping the bombs on people. And
because you know, every once in a while a wage theft story comes up, you know, and it's like the biggest thief is that Hardee's manager with the clip-on tie. You know what I'm saying? shaving off those wages, you know, to get his profit and loss statement to balance out. And so the biggest theft is wage theft in the United States. At the same time, we're getting squeezed with austerity and rents and evictions, and and it's just there's no end to it until we put an end to it.
That's right. That's right.
And people are beginning. People are, especially younger people are very anxious about climate change, and you know, they found out that it's been known for 40 years and nothing has been done, and it's really having an impact on our younger generations, and we've got to work in their best effort to
do. Yeah, the most like deadliest time of the year, you know, it being like around like July, like when it's hot, like, you know, on the news, they'd be for years they've been showing it, like, you know, how relating the heat index, you know, relating the like atmospheric temperatures in the sky with the with it, you know, relating it with the temperature level that they was, the temperature check they was giving, you know, in regards to the people, you know, and the crime rates and stuff. And like July, oh gosh, it'd be so crazy, like, you know, the water be in the street, you know, like opening the fire hydrants and everything. So, you know, but it'd still be hot. It'd be, you know, it'd be like crazy hot, you know, and there'd be crazy homicides, you know, in the news, on the radio, you know. My mom would be listening to the, what was it, last night, Mom, when there was shots? Yeah, it was like right on the corner that you know, that where my mom lives at, you know, there's, what, five street organizations? Yeah, fighting for this corner, you know, and it's, you know, if the economic system was different, if instead of capitalism, there was, you know, cooperation, you know, and mutual aid, you know, like we see things cool down on a level that's super mellow, you know, a lot more mellow than what they are now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got to keep the fight. We got to keep it
right.
Going. Thank you very much, Lamar Hibachi.
I appreciate y'all. You know, everybody tuning in, that's what's up. Salute to y'all. I take my hat off to y'all. Think about these things before you go to sleep tonight.
That's right. A new world is possible.
Yeah, and we can make it right now.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Solidarity.
It's about time. What time is it? It's time to organize.
Right. Around the clock, baby.
That's right.